This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program for the morning. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we'll spend a little bit of time talking about the history of the Indianapolis 500. Fans of auto racing later this month will be celebrating the 91st running of the race. We'll talk a little bit about how it got started and perhaps how things have changed over the years and how it is that it has become arguably the world's most famous motorsport event. And our guest for the program is Donald Davidson. He is the official historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and I think probably knows more about this race and its history than just about anybody else. He is the co-author of the official history of the Indianapolis 500, available in book form, published by the Crash Media Group. And it's really a lovely book. If people are interested in racing, it is full of stories about the race over the years, has lots and lots of great photographs. So that's a book that you can go out and take a look at. And of course, as we move along here through the hour, questions are welcome. I know he would do his best to answer your question. If you'd like to call in, the number is 333-9455. That's for folks who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. But we do also have a toll-free line, and that means no matter where you're listening, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along, but if, of course, anybody who is interested in calling in should feel welcome. Mr. Davidson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Or good afternoon, rather.
It probably is afternoon where you are, isn't it?
It is.
Let me, if you'd forgive me for right up front, actually beginning by mentioning another sporting event. This weekend is the Kentucky Derby.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the Derby is that for people who know nothing about horse racing,
yep,
pay no attention to it, watch no other race during the year, if you're only going to watch one, this is the one you watch.
Yes.
And it seems to me it is something like the case with the 500. That is, a lot of people who aren't, you know, who don't regularly follow auto racing, if they only watch one race a year, mm-hmm, this is the one that they watch,
yep,
the 500. So how, I guess the question is, how is it that the 500 became this kind of iconic event?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely correct. In fact, the two sort of go hand in hand in some ways. There are people that may attend both, and they don't go to another horse race, and they don't go to another automobile race. And then as far as following it, I mean, it is they are both events where the event itself, you know, transcends anybody that's ever participated in it. How the 500 got its reputation, that's nothing that happened recently. I think that was pretty much right off the bat. The track was built in 1909. And the first 500-mile race was held in 1911. So a lot of people think that that it started with the 500-mile race. It did not. That was in their third season. But the original event, the first event, inaugural, drew a huge crowd, and so it was established virtually from the very beginning.
And just to make sure, in case anybody is confused about why it's called 500, it is indeed because, not because they go around 500 times, but because it's 500 miles.
That is correct, yes. Yeah. It's 200 laps of a 2.5-mile course. But almost from the very beginning, I mean, they had huge crowds for the first race that came from mostly by train.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, all the way through the teens, 20s, and 30s, it was certainly the best-known race in the United States. And I think that after a while, then it became, as you said, arguably the best-known race in the world.
Sure. Just to establish how it has grown over the years, maybe some numbers would be interesting. For example, as you say, it was quite a good crowd at the beginning, though. But how many people turned out to see the race in 1911?
They estimated at 80,000, and the term estimate is all you're ever going to hear because they have never released figures officially, and any figure that's ever been published over the years has been newspaper estimates or sometimes law enforcement. The state police announced figures for a while, and then I think they don't do that anymore. So it's just very much of a guesstimate. I think in more recent years, so in the 80s probably, it was up around 400,000 because it used to have a huge infield crowd, which has diminished for a variety of reasons, just the makeup, just the layout of the plant. There used to be, it was very, much of it was infield, grass. Now there's a lot of buildings where there didn't used to be buildings, and a golf course, which has existed since 1929, was revamped in 1992, which there's a lot of area where they used to actually park the cars on the golf course, and they won't do that anymore. In terms of seating, they won't say that either, but it's in the region of 300,000. And so a crowd of 350,000 or thereabouts is probably typical. And to go back to the very beginning, as I mentioned, 80,000 was estimated in 1911, and I've gone through and done quite a bit of newspaper research through the microfilm, and the newspaper coverage was just fantastic in the early days. And Union Station, which was the railway station downtown, estimated that 75,000 people had gone through there, and it was the biggest day that they'd ever had.
Wow, in downtown, Union Station, downtown Chicago.
Downtown Indianapolis.
Oh, Union Station.
That
I guess I was thinking about the other Union Station, the one that's in Chicago.
Oh, I think there's one in St. Louis as well.
But oh, okay.
No, the Union Station.
Maybe there's one everywhere.
Yeah. So there were trains that came from all over the country, and of course, another thing in those days was the wealthy people would arrive in their own Pullman, so mm-hmm. they would go over into the sidings. So it was just a very, very busy day just by train traffic.
So if you add in the number of people, let us say you add in the number of people who watch coverage of the race on television or listen to on radio, could you come up with a ballpark figure of today, the audience for the 500?
Not really. The radio audience is still substantial, but I mean, it used to be fantastic, and you know, all the way through the 50s and the early 60s, radio was king.
Mm-hmm.
And your point at the beginning of the program certainly relates to radio, because there was probably millions of people that would listen to the 500-mile race on Memorial Day that wouldn't even pay attention to motor racing the rest of the year.
Sure.
But whatever that audience was, I mean, it eventually became available all over the world. In fact, their claim was that it was available in every country where English is spoken except behind the Iron Curtain. And once somebody estimated 100 million listeners. Well, maybe that's a little high, but that's radio only. And then, of course, television, it's now available around the world, and there's other ways that you can plug into the event. I mean, I don't understand modern technology, but you can listen to the public address on your computer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's literally available for millions of people. And I'm going to tell you a little self-serving story, which really took me by surprise. 1 year, when the day before the race, I was standing with some people, and a fellow came up to me, and he was from Australia, and he asked me if I was me, and I said yes, and he said, "Well, I recognize your voice." He'd never been to the track before. He was from Australia, and he'd listened to the race there and recognized my voice.
Wow.
So, and that was probably 25 years ago or more. So just the full impact of it just sort of really hit me right there, that, you know, you have to be, whatever you're saying, people may be listening to you in places that you never even dreamed of.
Well, that's a good thing to try to remember when you're on the
air. Yes.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Donald Davidson. He's the current historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He is the co-author, along with Rick Schaefer, of the Auto Course Official History of the Indianapolis 500. And that is one volume with lots and lots of stories and photographs that you can go to if you're interested in the history of the race. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just again, to give people a sense of how things have changed over the years, how many cars were there in the first race in 1911?
There were 46 entries, and there were only two what we refer to as no-shows, which is rather surprising. So 44 of the 46 showed up, and 40 met the qualification requirements. If I can just do a couple of disclaimers about the potential phone questions.
Oh, sure.
I'm what the Brits call a sentimental old silly. I happily live in the past. I don't like controversy. I'm not a gearhead. I like the people and the anecdotes from the past. So I'm not into controversial disputes. A friend of mine a few years ago had this great line about watching television, and he said, "I really watch television, but when I do, I just keep flipping the channels till the picture's black and white, and then I stop." I thought, well, that sounds like me. So as far as questions are concerned, the further back you want to go, the happier I am.
Well, the thing that I always tell guests is that the callers can ask any kind of question that might occur to us, but I always would tell the guest, well, that's they always have the option of saying, well, that's a fine question, but I'm not the guy who has the answer for you.
Questions that involve opinion are I have to be very guarded, because my views are not necessarily those of the management.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just try to be, non-controversial and talk about the neat stuff that happened in years past.
Sure. Well, then just let me round out this question. So in 1911, there were 40 cars qualified.
Yes.
For the race. Last year, how many cars qualified?
It's 33.
So
it's 33 qualifiers.
So it's approximately the same number of cars. How about the, if I asked you, say, in 1911, what was the average, the top speed of the car?
In practice, they didn't qualify the way they do now, but in practice, those were unofficial speeds. Some people were lapping at 88 miles per hour.
Well, that's respectable, 88.
Yeah. And then the race average was 75, mm-hmm. 75.601.
And last year, what would those numbers have been?
Well, the race average is now a little confusing. If you look at the average speeds for the last few years, they're up and down and up and down. And the reason for that is that whenever there's a problem of some kind, an accident, or somebody drops some oil, they throw out what is known as the caution. The yellow light comes on and the yellow flag is waved, and everybody has to slow down during the caution period. And the pace car, this year it's a Corvette, pulls onto the track, and then everybody lines up in single file, and they run about 85 to 90 mile an hour laps, but obviously the speeds are regulated, and the more caution laps you have, the slower your average speed's going to be. And the record set in 1990, which may last forever, was 185.981 miles an hour for 500 miles. There was only four brief cautions. So you'll look, and it'll be, 175 one year, and then 153 the next, and then it's, back up into the 170s again. So it is a little misleading.
Yeah. I guess I'm just thinking about just to get an idea about how fast the drivers are going.
Oh, all right then. Well, the track record was set in 1996, and you think, well, what happened in the last 10 years? Well, that was the last year that they permitted turbochargers on the cars here, and a driver named Arie Luyendyk, that's a bit of a mouthful, he's a Dutchman who lives in the Phoenix area, he had qualifying laps at 237 miles an hour.
Wow.
They had a lap in practice, which is when you're out there. When you qualify, it's four consecutive laps. And so it's possible to run a single lap in practice faster. He actually did a 239, which is about 38.5 seconds to do 2.5 miles with four left-hand turns. With the changing of the specifications, the speeds dropped down to about 218. They've been up to 233. This year, probably we'll be looking at 225 to 230, I would think.
So they're definitely going over 200 miles an hour.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Well, we have a caller to bring in here to the conversation. Let's do that. Someone
okay.
Here is in Urbana, where we are, and line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Since you're of British extraction, I have a question.
Okay.
How is it that oval racing and closed course racing in America was more prevalent than the open road racing in Europe? And the how come in Europe road racing is more popular than it is here?
Well, oval track racing in Europe has always been just about non-existent. There's been an attempt. There was a track built in Germany and a track built in England in very recent years that haven't done well at all financially. It probably goes back to the very beginning when racing in Europe was on road courses, or in fact not even closed courses to begin with. I mean, they had, before the turn of the century and immediately after, late 1800s, early 1900s, they had what were known as city-to-city races. And they would go Paris to Madrid and Paris to Vienna and things of that nature. I mean, just across country roads with people standing alongside the roads. That was very dangerous. So there was, as a result of something that happened in 1903, then most of the racing went to closed courses, but they were all over public roads. It was a while before anybody started to build road courses. There was a track in England called Brooklands in Weybridge, just a short distance from London. That was what we now call a multi-purpose facility, and it had an oval of sorts, steeply banked. There's legend that Indianapolis Speedway was influenced by Brooklands. In fact, the Indianapolis Speedway was being proposed as early as 1905. But the early events in the United States, and I'll eventually answer your question, were many of them were road racing events.
The Vanderbilt Cup, weren't they?
I'm sorry?
The Vanderbilt Cup.
The Vanderbilt Cup on Long Island was held in 1904. And yes, that was a course over public roads, and it was quite a long lap, and so they would do a certain number of laps to make up the distance. At the same time, the automobile was a curiosity, and they started to run them on county fairgrounds tracks, horse tracks. The county fairs were a half a mile, and the state fairs were a mile. And it sort of seemed to take off from there and be very successful and the forerunner of what later became known as sprint car racing. And just for some reason, road courses fell by the wayside in this country, and everything was pretty much oval. And in Europe and the rest of the world, it never caught on.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know if that gets you a decent answer.
I'd written an article about the stock chassis race a while back in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Fairmount Park.
Fairmount Park, yeah.
Yeah, I think it ran for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like with the early beginnings of motor racing, we had open road courses. And I began to wonder whether it was sort of like the county fair thing was the big tie-in for the closed small course racing.
It was. And in fact, there's two different... we get a little philosophical here. The early motor racing events, the idea was that it was an opportunity for the manufacturers to show the public how good their automobiles were.
It was with us, I think.
It was, well, that was the original intent,
yeah.
That it would be testing. The factories would enter the cars, and it would be testing, but also there would be competition, but the people could decide for themselves which car they wanted to buy. The oval track events, all dirt, tended to be sort of like a thrill show for thrills and spills and excitement and for entertainment. And so the manufacturers in road racing events, even over a period of a few years, they just dropped out, and things kept changing. I'm sorry?
Do you think it was distance? Because you could have an international race from, say, Paris to Berlin or Paris,
yes.
And you would have the attention of several countries along with those that were providing vehicles.
That's correct.
Yeah, whereas here in America, you know, going from Paris, you know, going from New York to Philadelphia, mm-hmm. we could have very easily crossed several borders in Europe and have not even and you still have, you know, within the country kind of a race.
Well, it was bragging rights for the manufacturers, but what was happening was that policing the crowds was a problem, and so that's why you started to have the close courses come in, because you had more control over the keeping the public back. It's still kind of archaic compared with today, but the oval track at the county fair and the state fairground type events were much more of entertainment, and it was that's when the drivers became the stars. And if you ran, what you call a sprint-type program, where you would run a series of heats and then a main event or feature, if you like, you could then, hawk food and drink at the concession stand, and you'd run a heat and then take a break and go down and get something to eat and drink and then come back up, and then there'd be another heat.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the
call.
All
right, thank you.
Just real quick, now I'm curious, Mr. Davidson, are in Europe, in Formula One, are there still races where they run what are closed courses but are on city streets?
The few and far between. Monaco mm-hmm. is one. There is a course in Belgium, Spa-Francorchamps, which keeps changing, but they use it in some years and not in others. But anyway, that's public roads. That's the only two that I can think of at the moment. Virtually everything that is, and they used to be all public roads, but now everything else that I can think of is a purpose-built racing facility.
Mm-hmm. In this hour, our guest is Donald Davidson. He is the current historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And we thought it might be interesting, and it actually, I guess I would say this was a suggestion from a listener, to spend some time here to talk a little bit about one motor race in particular, arguably the most famous, most followed motorsport event in the world, and that's the Indianapolis 500 that will be coming up later this month. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. By the way, if you're interested in reading the history of the race, you might take a look at a book that our guest has co-authored. It's the Auto Course Official History of the Indianapolis 500. And we have a number of other people here with questions. Let's talk with someone next in Charleston, line number 3. Hello. Yes.
I understand that back when the roadsters were king at the speedway, that there was a big discrepancy between the speeds on the straightaways and in the turns, and that now with the aerodynamics and bigger tires, wider tires and everything, that they're actually going faster at with even smaller engines. And the other question, I'd like to have you talk about that, but the question I have is, do the average drivers, if they got a clear, if they're clear ahead of them, do they need to touch the brakes going into turns 1 and 3?
Okay, the answer is you're absolutely correct. It used to be with when you had narrow tires, they weren't running nearly as fast as they are now, but they had narrow tires, and the speed difference between peak on the straightaway and going through the turns was quite a bit. When the track record was, say, 150 miles an hour, they probably would reach 175 on the straightaways, and then they would lift and brake for the turns and then go through the turns, I don't know, maybe 120 or something like that. So there would be quite a bit of difference. When they started to go to wider tires, rear-engine cars from front to rear, and then more and more aerodynamics, and instead of the driver sitting upright and, you know, almost driving like a truck, it was like driving a truck, and they'd be swinging away at the wheel. Then they were now lying down on their back with a little tiny steering wheel, and the track was extremely smooth and no more bricks because the surface used to be bricks. It became more precise, and with the widening of the tires, they got better grip in the turns, and so it became less and less necessary to slow down. So I can remember that in the first few years that I was around, even when you were not at the track, but just a straight or two away, you would hear them come down the straightaway, and then you could tell that they would lift for 2 or 3 seconds, and it would be a combination of lifting off the throttle and tapping the brake in order to negotiate the turn, and then back on the throttle. And you noticed through 66, 67, 68, 69, that interval in which they were off the throttle was getting less and less. And now they pretty much are full throttle all the way around. The speeds vary, but it's normally because the speed is being scrubbed off as the cars are going through the turn. But if you're lapping at 230, and this is just hypothetical, you're probably reaching 235, 236 on the straightaway, and you know, maybe 220, 225 through the turn. So the variance in speed is very little compared with what it once was.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. And we'll go on here and talk next with someone in Madison, Wisconsin. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hey, Donald. I got 3 quick questions for you.
Okay.
First of all, one of the things I really enjoyed about the race in the 70s were the aerial bombs going off at the end of the race.
Yeah.
Do you think the Speedway would ever bring them back again?
No, and I would hope not. That went until, I think, late 80s or early 90s, and it used to be a shock to the system for me because they'd come down for the start and go through turn one, and about the time that they would, between turns one and two, this cluster of aerial bombs would be exploded, and you think, What's that? There's been a crash, and so it would take me by surprise every year. And personally, I was very happy when they stopped doing it. So I don't think they would ever revive that.
Okay, I guess I just really enjoyed it as a 14-year-old kid.
Well, there's actually from the very beginning, they used to use aerial bombs as timekeepers, and they would go with the opening of the gates at whatever time it is, 5 o'clock in the morning in recent years. And they used to let a bomb off every hour, and then they would, as they got closer to the race, they'd be down to half hour and 15 minutes. Well, now the only one they do is to open the track. And it's very effective, and I have a chuckle, because in this modern day and age, they want everybody to know that it's time to open the gates. You could have, you know, you could spend $500,000 on a communication system, computerized, to let everybody know. And what do? They let a bomb off. It goes bang, and everybody at all the gates around the track knows it's time to open the gates. What could be simpler?
There you go. My second question, I heard that Joey Chitwood was of Native American descent, and I've read in a few places that he was the only driver until Corey Witherhill came along recently. He was the only Native American driver before him. But then in Chris Economaki's book, he says that he asked Joey Chitwood, and he says, "No, I just look like an Indian." Would you know the final word on that?
Well, I've got a personal opinion on that, and I don't quite know what to say about it. It was almost my understanding that he was, and if you look at him, he looks extremely Indian.
Okay.
There are other drivers that have had Indian blood, and so that's the fact that Joey Chitwood, the grandson, is now the president of the Speedway. He also says that it's not true, so it puts you in a bit of a spot because you have your personal opinion, and it would be very hard for me after all these years to accept the fact that there was no Indian blood in there at all.
Okay. And my final question, Chris Economaki, he's such an inspiration for just about everybody I call him a moto journalist. In fact, that's what I am, and he was certainly my inspiration as a kid. Over in England, was he perhaps somewhat of an inspiration for you to get into the business you're in today?
Oh, no. No. I mean, I knew who he was. The first time I ever heard of Chris Economaki was in 1957 when I was now following motor racing and reading a publication called Autosport, which I couldn't afford, but a local landlord took it and then would give it to me when he was done. And when the Indianapolis cars went to Monza in Italy in 1957, Chris Economaki went over and actually did the English public address.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the first time I knew who he was. And then I was familiar with the name when I was first at the track in 64.
All right. Well, thank you for your answers. I'm really enjoying the show.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We will continue. I think next we'll talk with someone in Belgium. That is over by Danville, the town, Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I hope I'm not going across already trodden ground. I'd like to know a little bit about the Holman family relationship to it and the Clabber Girl baking powder.
Okay.
Didn't it have a lot to do with it in the beginning?
It did indeed. Well, not in the beginning. Tony Holman purchased the track in 1945. The Holmans didn't start the track. There were four founders in 1908, 1909. The four partners, the principal was Carl Fisher, who is the same man who developed Miami Beach from swamplands into a resort area. And then he also was the man that spearheaded the Lincoln Highway Commission, which built the first drivable highway across the country.
Wasn't he also owner of Fisher Body Works?
No. That's a very common question. Carl Fisher had nothing to do with Fisher Auto Body. That was another family from Ohio.
Oh.
But anyway, Fisher had three partners, and the principal one was James Allison, who a few years later began what became Allison Engineering Company. Anyway, they sold the track in 1927 to a group that was headed up by World War I flying ace Eddie Rickenbacker, who had, in fact, been a driver in the 500 before he ever learned how to fly a plane.
Hmm.
And so as the World War I hero, he was set up in business by some bankers in Detroit, and it came to pass that in 27, then he purchased the track, or arranged for the purchase of the track, from the original group. In 1945, he sold it to Anton Holman Jr. of Terre Haute. Tony Holman was a third-generation American. His grandfather was a German immigrant, and they were in the wholesale grocery business. And the company that put them on the map was Clabber Girl, which they had acquired. And it actually had the legend is that they had they had Clabber Girl for some time, and it hadn't done much. And when Tony Holman came back from college in Yale, One of the first things that he was told was, see what you can do with this. And so apparently he very quietly went out and put Clapper Girl on the map and put the Holmans on the map.
I see. Thank you very much, sir.
And in fact, maybe I could just make this point right now, because mm-hmm. I think it's even the locals don't purely understand this. The remarkable thing about the Indianapolis Speedway is that it's owned by a private, it's privately owned. And it, and for all intents and purposes, it's that family from Terre Haute. So they do not take any tax dollars, which is pretty amazing. Everything, every time they think they need a new grandstand or something that needs to be done, they pay for it. They do not go to public funds. I mean, they have, they sell naming rights and they have sponsors and partners and so on and so forth. But as far as the locals are concerned, there's not a penny comes out of your restaurant tax or anything like that at all. And whenever they want to build something, they just do it.
Let's talk again with another caller. This next person is Champagne, in Champagne, and on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
I have never been to any kind of automobile race, nor do I believe that I would ever attend.
Uh-huh.
My son goes periodically and really enjoys it. My question to you, sir, is what is it that bring people out to watch cars going around an oval or a circle or whatever? To me, it would seem to be the ultimate in boredom.
Well, I think you can. I think it's you can make that case of anything, and don't take this the wrong way. But I mean, if you could say the same thing about football, if you don't care about football, you could say the same thing about chess or collecting stamps or any one of you know dozens and dozens of other activities. You either like it or you don't, and people have all kinds of different opinions. And motor racing is probably boring for some people and not others.
Why do you like it?
Why do I like it? Probably my interest in it is different from what anybody else, how somebody else may perceive it. It's more than to me. I mean, I'm not a great race goer, and this is kind of maybe a little hard to really explain. But when I first got interested in motor racing, I was interested in the stats, the results. I've always been a stat freak. And so I've been involved with the sport, I mean, since the mid-1960s professionally. I worked for a company called the United States Auto Club, USAC, which was a sanctioning body. And I was their historian and record keeper. And I really went to events. I would go occasionally, but I was not a great race goer. You know, it's either hot or it's cold or it's raining or it's dusty and, you know, you're tired and you've got to drive home. But I wanted to know what was going on. I wanted to know all of the results and everything and the stats and a bunch of things that probably would be boring to somebody else. That, you know, so-and-so has now completed so many laps in his career and he just moved from, you know, 17th to 16th on the all-time standings or something like that. So I think that another point I wanted to make, too, and this sort of came up at the beginning of the program, you've got people that are interested in the Indianapolis 500 that don't go to any other race or have any interest in other races. It is an event. There's so much character about it, an atmosphere with the pre-race celebrations and just the fact that a huge crowd comes. There's electricity in the air. And a crowd draws a crowd, but I would never, argue for or against motorsport. And I know that there are people who think that it's, you know, how boring can it be to watch cars go around in circles? Well, you could say, you know, how boring. You know, why would you spend a lot of money to go and watch a football game where fellows are running up and down the ground, you know, and falling down and throwing a ball around or basketball? You know, people are dyed-in-the-wool basketball enthusiasts, and others think, you know, what could be more boring about two teams, you know, running up back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to throw a basket through a hoop, and the answer is you either like it or you don't. And so I would support anybody's hobby. And I tell, off on another tangent here, but I mean, I tell when I speak to school kids, if you don't have a hobby, get one. And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's collecting rocks or doing needlepoint, or you've got to have something in your life that you enjoy and look forward to and can immerse yourself in when the opportunity arises.
Our guest, I need to jump in here. I'd like to introduce again the guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We are talking in this hour with Donald Davidson. He is the current historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and knows quite a lot about the history of auto racing. He is the co-author of the Auto Course Official History of the Indianapolis 500. And we're talking a bit about this race. Someone suggested, well, why don't you do something on the history of the race? And later this month, indeed, people will celebrate the 91st running of the race. The first one was in 1911, and it's run almost every year. There were a couple of years where the race was not run, but it's almost run every year since that time. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What did the winner of that first race in 1911 get?
The prize money was the posted prize money was $10,000 for first place. They also had what was known as posted accessory money, and so it was contingency money. If you won or finished second or third or whatever it was, and you used a certain product, then you get additional money. So it was actually $14,250. With regard for the last caller, mm-hmm. I don't want it to appear that I was beating up on him or making fun of basketball or football. I was just simply making the point that, I've had people say to me, motor racing is stupid. Well, everything's stupid. You either like it or you don't.
No, that's fine. I would hope that he would not take your, and no one would take your comments personally.
Yeah.
I don't think they were offered in that way. So in 1911, $14,000 bucks, the winner got. This year, 2007, what will the winner of the 500 get?
Oh, it varies. It's up in the $1.5 million range. But it fluctuates. The purse has been $10 million approximately for about the last 5 or 6 years, and again, that winner's share fluctuates even more now, depending on accessory money and what else you have done throughout the month of May, because just winning the pole position to be the person who qualifies for the number one starting position, there's a huge amount of prize money on that, mm-hmm. In excess of $100,000. In fact, there is a prize of $100,000 plus some others. So this has happened several times where the pole car is the first one out and maybe is out on the first lap in a couple of instances. And the total prize money is like the equivalent of about third or fourth place in the race. They also have lap money. There's $450 for every lap that you lead. And so, obviously, if you dominate the race, if you win the pole and lead the greater number of laps, you're going to get considerably more prize money than if you started near the back and took the lead late. Mm. But it's normally $1.5 to $1.7 million in recent years.
And that's obviously that's a lot of money, but it also costs a lot of money field a car.
Yes. The days of making a profit are pretty much gone by the wayside. You could come on a wing and a prayer and win the race and leave with a lot more than you came with, but now you cannot, as far as just on prize money. There's a lot of money in endorsements, but where the money is raised is the sponsorship. All of the decals and all of the names that you see on the car, those sometimes account for vast sums of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a few other callers here. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Next, we'll talk with someone here in Urbana, where we are, and that's line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Go ahead, yes.
Yes, I am not a NASCAR fan, and one of the reasons is I think of all the fuel going to waste for men driving around in circles. But my question is, would you have any idea of what the total number of gallons the NASCAR fuel the NASCAR industry uses in the course of the year, both in practice and in races?
I would have no idea at all, but it would be a considerable amount because you have the practice sessions and also you have open test sessions. It would be considerable. All I can say is that as far as the Indianapolis 500 is concerned, this year they're going to be using ethanol. Okay. They were using methanol, but now it's ethanol. And in the testing, they were very surprised to find that the consumption is at the rate of about 3.2 miles to the gallon, and you might think, well, that's terrible, but on methanol, they were getting about 1.8 to 1.9. But in turn, now the NASCAR was using leaded fuel until this year. Now they've gone to unleaded gasoline, and I don't know what the consumption is, but in a year's time, yes, it is a considerable amount.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So, and I guess we want to make sure that people are clear, again, who don't know anything about racing, that NASCAR and the 500 are different events. They're different kinds of racing. The cars are different. So the Indianapolis 500 is not a NASCAR event.
No. However, there is a NASCAR event that takes place at the Indianapolis Speedway
At the track,
yes.
Yeah, but that's a different
a
different thing.
Completely different.
All right. And is it now, so this year at Indianapolis, are the cars running on 100% ethanol?
Yes. They call it 100%. It's probably about 98%.
Ah, that's right, E98 or something.
It's not pure
like that.
Ethanol, uh-huh. but it's about 98%.
All right. Okay, let's talk with someone in Mattoon next, line three. Hello.
Yes, good.
Hi.
Could you comment about the Sports Pub Car of America and some of the drivers that have come through that program to the Indianapolis 500? I have a son-in-law that races the Formula Atlantic in SCCA.
Yes. Well, the number of drivers that have come to Indianapolis from SCCA would be considerable. But it's a little hard to answer that in that did anybody come with only SCCA background? No. I mean, you've got people like Dan Gurney that had a strong SCCA background, but he had already been running in Europe before he came to Indianapolis for the first time. But the number of people who have had some SCCA experience and come to Indianapolis, I mean, there would be, I could go on for quite some time. I'm not ducking it, but in more recent years, less and less, you've got more and more foreign drivers, and plus you've got Americans that found other routes other than going through SCCA.
Okay, I just wanted to comment that it's strictly a hobby sport, and those people receive no prize money except for the national championships in SCCA.
Well, eventually that they began to have. I mean, that's how the organization was founded. I think in 1944, they had a strict policy against. They would throw you out if they found out that you were being paid anything at all. And finally, in 1963, is when they first began to have some professional events. But the majority of the racing to this day is yes, it's use the term amateur. That's not meant to say that it's amateurish. It's just that they run for no prize money.
That is correct. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks.
All right, thank
we'll
you.
Try to get at least one more. Here's a caller in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hello, Donald. How are you?
I'm fine. I've heard of Terre Haute.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm driving my truck today. I'm from the Indianapolis area, and I listen to you on radio station Indianapolis, which one we know about.
Thank you.
For the local folks, and love talking to you every year, and probably maybe talk to you later tonight. The question I wanted to ask you real briefly, because the gentleman said we had a brief amount of time, was Joe Dawson.
Yes.
In 1912, if I remember the story, help me out here. His car had broken down, and he actually had pushed the car to the finish line. Is that
you've got, two
right
things
now?
Running together. That was Ralph De Palma. Ralph De Palma was an Italian immigrant who lived in the United States for several years, and he led 196 of the 200 laps. And the only four that he didn't lead were laps 1 and 2 and 199 and 200. And when he broke down with just over about a lap and a quarter to go, he and the riding mechanic got out and pushed the car around actually to complete the 199th lap rather than the 200. Joe Dawson was the fellow that had been running second, and he was five laps behind, but then he began to unlap himself as De Palma ran into the problems, and he was able to win the race. And he was an outstanding driver, but he's in the record books as having won the race by leading only the last two laps.
And these guys that pushed their car for the last lap and a half, they didn't win the race, but
no, they
finished.
Did not win the race, no. But one of the most famous stories ever at the Speedway, and it's been at, there's photographs of it, and an artist named Peter Halk did a well-known painting of it.
There's so much more here that we could talk about, and unfortunately, we are here at the time that we have to finish. I just one last thing. I'm curious for you to talk a little bit about the man who won the first race, and the unique invention
that
he put on his car that previously weren't on cars, and of course now we all have them.
That was the rearview mirror.
Ray
Haroon, who I used to go and see, so I'm doing a little more self-serving and name-dropping, but in the final years of his life, he lived in Anderson, Indiana, and I used to go see him, and the story on the mirror was that they built a single-seat car for 1911, and they had the streamlined body, and so they had a narrow car that would cut through the air with greater ease, and also they were saving the weight of a second person. During practice, there were complaints from other competitors that he didn't have a riding mechanic to appraise him of the fact that somebody was coming at one side or the other. So he got around the complaints. He put up four rods above the cowling and mounted what is believed to be the very first rear-view mirror ever used on an automobile, and he had seen it done on a horse-drawn vehicle in Chicago in 1904, remembered that, and then used it when it became important in 1911. But it's believed to be, disclaimer, asterisk, believed to be the first use of an automobile on a rear view mirror on an automobile.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop. If you'd like to learn more about the history of the Indianapolis 500, look for the book, The Auto Course Official History of the Indianapolis 500, co-authored by Rick Schaefer and our guest this morning, Donald Davidson. He is the current historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mr. Davidson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it, and thank you everybody that called in.